Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is our producer, Lee Cantor, and my good buddy and co-host, Todd Schnick. What's happening, Todd?
Not much, Stone. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Looked like you might have a little hitch in your get-along when I saw you come off the elevator this morning. Did anything special happen this weekend we ought to know about?
Oh, no. Not unlike in the other day. There's always a hitch in my get-along. But I did run a half marathon this past Saturday, so that may explain it.
So what was that like being with the 30,000 of your closest friends traipsing through Nashville?
It was pretty cool. I have to be honest. I was on the main drag in downtown Nashville, and when that gun starts and 30,000 people are out there together doing something amazing, it was pretty cool to be part of that.
So what's the hardest part about preparing for and executing on a marathon, and what did you find the most fun now that you've finally done it from end to end?
The most fun is actually the same thing as the most difficult. It's race day itself isn't that hard if you've been training for it, and I have so getting out there 3-4 days a week and running is the hard part. You got to be disciplined to do that, and when you're a busy entrepreneur like me, it's hard to find time to do that. But satisfying thing about it and the most fun about it is the sense of accomplishment that you have every time you finish a training day. Finishing 3 miles around the house is just as satisfying as completing that, crossing that finish line on Saturday.
So is this something now you're crossing it off your bucket list? It's a done deal. Is it part of a brand new chapter of your life? Where do we go from here?
You know, when I first got into it, I thought it was just a one-time thing just to see if I could do it. But I think this is going to become a big part of my life. In fact, I already got the training plan done and scheduled to do the next one on September 5th in Virginia Beach.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow you, man. We're looking forward to it. Well, first up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning, I am delighted to introduce a gentleman by the name of Skip Freeman. The title of his new book is called Headhunter Hiring Secrets, The Rules of the Hiring Game Have Changed Forever. Welcome to the show, Skip.
It's great to be here, Stone.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Tell us a little bit about this book and what compelled you to write it.
Well, what compelled me to write it is I've been in executive search for about 7 years. Prior to that, about 20-plus years in sales marketing, and the military. And one of the things that I've had the privilege of being a part of is a lot of high-performing teams. And so 7 years ago, when we founded our executive search firm, we called it Hire to Win because we wanted to help companies identify, qualify, attract, and land the best talent so that they could build their teams to hire to win. As I have experienced the last 7 years in executive search, one of the things that I have come to realize, however, is that most companies have flawed hiring processes. Even though they would like to be able to hire to win, they have a lot of processes in place that prevent them from being able to do that. Candidates, at the same time, when they look for a new opportunity, they think companies know what they're doing.
Imagine that.
Exactly. And also, good candidates are very good at what they do. They're good at, for example, being a chemist or an accountant or a sales manager or a marketing professional. Most candidates are very poor when it comes to looking for their next career opportunity. And the reason is most people look for a new job 5, 6, 7 times in their career, but they're doing their profession every single day. And so as I begin to realize that most companies have flawed hiring processes and most candidates don't know how to look for a new job, there's a huge disconnect. And that was the motivation for writing the book, to help the candidates understand what they actually need to do to win the hiring game, and yes, it is a game, and also in parallel to help companies learn how to properly hire and build their teams to hire to win.
Skip, there's a lot of thought leadership out there, a lot of great books like yours that educate businesses on how not to have flawed business hiring processes. But why did that still happen? Why is that such a common phenomenon?
Well, I think there's three components to the title of the book. Headhunter Hiring Secrets is one, rules is one, and hiring game is one. The question you're asking deals with the rules. One of the rules of the hiring game is that you should be able to describe what a person will do. And one of the reasons we have flawed hiring processes is people get busy in this economy with 7 to 8 million jobs having been lost over the last 3 years. We have companies that are running lean and mean, but they're also burnt out. They don't have the time to be able to invest in a hiring process. Give you a quick example. A job description typically reads something like, we're looking for somebody with 5 to 10 years of experience who has a BS degree in XYZ, who could be from a manufacturing environment, as an example, and then they go into the soft skills, excellent communication skills, able to multitask, able to work on high-performing teams, and yet what happens is they're describing the person, they're not describing what this person will do. And that's one of the main reasons for flawed hiring processes today, is they're trying to describe a person, they don't describe what this person will do, and thus there's a huge disconnect. A job seeker will look at a job posting, go, well, I can do that, and yeah, they can, but they don't meet what the company is actually looking for. So helping companies to learn to write position profiles and talk about what a job really entails and what a person will do versus just a spec of a person is one of the big disconnects.
So what kind of mistakes is an organization likely to make if they don't avail themselves of someone like you and utilize a professional headhunter, recruiter like you? What are some of the misconceptions that they might hold and some of the mistakes they might make?
Well, in today's market, a lot of companies think that because there are a lot of people in the market that they don't need a recruiter. So what they do is they'll make a posting. And I'll give you an example. A client of mine that got some stimulus money back in the fall was able to create 20 positions because of the stimulus money. So they posted 20 positions. They received over 14,000 applications to these 20 positions. And so they can't go through them all. So they finally turned to me and said, Skip, can you help us go through these? Can you help us sort the wheat from the chaff to find out really who can do the job? A company that I'm beginning to work with right now, we're working on one position with them. They said, Skip, in this economy, we'd like to try to hire on our own first, rightly so. But the position has now been open since August because they get so many applications and so many responses from people that really aren't qualified to do the job because their job description actually is very poor, that they aren't able to identify, qualify, attract, and land the right people. So what we're able to do is talk to the hiring managers. For example, I spent over an hour on the phone with the hiring manager to understand what is it that you really want this person to accomplish. Then I'm able to go into the marketplace, cold call into their competitors, which they can't do, and identify what we call passive talent, people buried in excellence doing the job today within the competitive companies, and present a compelling case for them to listen to my client's opportunity.
This happened last week. This happened last week.
We interrupt the High Velocity Radio Show so that we can listen to Todd cough.
What is there's a lot of talk that the traditional way of finding a job, putting the resume, posting on Monster is old school, that it's now there's a new modern way and using social media and LinkedIn and those kind of things. How does that apply? How does that affect your world?
Todd, excellent question. And that's where we go into the rules of the hiring game have changed forever. The traditional way of responding to a posting, blasting out your resume, unfortunately, is still the model that most people use, and it's very ineffective. Again, a case in point. I know one job seeker who sent his resume into 726 companies. Of the 726, he got 23 responses back, of which 20 of those were no's. He got 3 interviews and no job offer. So after 723 applications, or 726, 23 responses back, only 3 interviews and no job offers, that's clearly old school. So one of the things we go through in the book, Headhunter Hiring Secrets, is what are the strategies? What are the things people need to do today to get the attention of a hiring manager within a company and be able to get that opportunity?
Well, there's probably skills that someone looking for a job needs to learn in the new modern way of finding work. But there's probably a lot of training that's got to be done at the organizational level to know how to use these tools as well. Is that the case?
That is a case. LinkedIn is a huge tool today, the professional network for people. And as an example, as you build your network on LinkedIn, you're able to figure out who's who in the zoo, so to speak, within your companies. But there's also a backdoor way into LinkedIn called the LinkedIn Google X-ray search, which we discuss in the book. Using the LinkedIn X-ray search on Google, you actually have access to all 65 million people on LinkedIn, and they don't have to be part of your network. So one of the interesting tactics today is to find out who in the company you can network with. There are certain ways to call into companies and get people's attention and chat with them. You don't call in asking for a job. You call in, for example, saying, I saw that you're on LinkedIn. I have an interest in your company. Do you have 5 minutes to describe why you like working there? You begin to build a little bit of a relationship, and you find out who maybe the hiring managers are, and you send a direct mail piece into that company. Yes, U.S. certified mail works. In fact, it works better than responding to an online posting. In fact, when I market a lot of my candidates, and we can talk in a moment about how recruiters work, but 5% of the time I'll actually take a candidate to market, and what I do is I launch my campaign with a U.S. direct mail certified campaign into targeted hiring managers, and it works. They read snail mail.
So how does a person go about conducting a really effective job search campaign? And I mean, Todd, have you ever heard of this X-ray thing with Google?
I have not.
I've never even heard of that. What are some tips, some tricks for people to do to use in this economy?
Well, for example, let's talk about what a game actually is. A game is any event or situation in which there are two or more players who may either gain or lose based upon the decisions that other people make or do not make. So a lot of people do not view hiring as a game because they think a game is either something that's entertainment, a sporting event, or a diversion. But if you think of the expanded definition of a game that I've just described, you realize that hiring is a game. And games have certain characteristics, one being uncertainty. Well, when you're going after a job, there's lots of uncertainty. How do you mitigate that uncertainty? You have players, you have the payoffs, you have the strategies, rules, common knowledge, and uncommon knowledge. So let me quickly delve into common knowledge versus uncommon knowledge as a quick example. Common knowledge being the unemployment rate has doubled over the last 3 years. Have 15 million unemployed people. The news media keeps hounding us that things are bad. Uncommon knowledge, for example, what most people do not know is that 4 million people were hired in the month of February. 2.7 million jobs went unfilled. There's 6.7 million opportunities right there. Now, certainly you're not going to be qualified for all of those, but one of the uncommon pieces of knowledge out there is that plenty of people are getting hired every single month. So what do you do to differentiate yourself? First of all, only half the positions at best are posted on the internet. So using, for example, the LinkedIn X-ray search, you can identify people within companies that you can call into and get a little bit of insight. The next step is make that phone call, pick their brain. And again, there are ways to do that and ways not to do that. Then you follow up with a direct mail letter into the company. And a direct mail piece is a one-page letter that gives people reasons to hire you. A cover letter is what covers your resume. A direct mail piece does not include a resume. Then you follow up with a strategically placed phone call, followed by an email. And I'll give you an example. The last time I marketed a candidate, I targeted 17 companies. So sent 17 direct mail pieces to CEOs or VPs of sales. 4 companies were interested, and we got him a job offer, and he started his new job the 1st of March. A certified mail campaign into 17 companies is a lot better than applying online to 726, as the example I used earlier.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question. You took it away from me. Thanks a lot. But the strategy is better to target 20, say, companies, and that you identify as an organization that interests you and is a place where you think you can contribute. So you're better off targeting those 20 with a much more finite campaign than cold calling 700+.
Absolutely. You need to understand what your value proposition is. And actually, in phase one of your job search, you need to do preliminary planning and preparation so that you really do understand the value proposition. People have got to understand that companies are not in the business of hiring people. They're in the business of making money. And so that's what we've got to do. If you bring a solution to them that shows them how they can make money or save money, then you're going to be the resource they're going to invest in versus maybe a new piece of equipment. So they're not in the business of hiring anybody. They're in the business of making money, and the only two reasons they'll hire a person is because that person can make them money or save them money. That's it.
But I can't imagine you just call and say, hey, I have an idea to make you more money. That may occasionally get you someone to listen to, but it's all about developing that relationship first.
It is about developing the relationship. There are three reasons a person will get hired. The hiring manager likes you, they trust you, and they feel you can make them or save them money. So it is about building the relationship. Now, if we have two people who can equally make a company money or save them money, and the like and trust aren't there, they're not going to get hired. But a person that, if they like you and trust you, but also can't see how you can make them or save them money, you're not going to get hired. So it's like a three-legged stool. You've got to have all three legs of that stool.
So what do you tell your client, your company clients, and what do you tell candidates about interviewing?
Excellent question, Stone. I appreciate that. Let me give you an example of last week. There is a candidate I am working with for an opportunity. Now, when I found out a little bit about her, which I found out from LinkedIn, I gave her a call and I asked her the question. Let's, just for the sake of example, let's call her Kim. I go, Kim, my name is Skip Freeman. I'm an executive recruiter in the chemical industry. Just a quick curiosity question. Well, sure, Skip. If one of the clients I'm working with has an opportunity that could be stronger than what you're doing today, would you be open to hearing about it? And she responded, yes. So as we delved into that conversation, she told me two things. One, in her current position, she travels 90% of the time and would like to reduce that travel. But she also wants to move forward towards something in calling on hospitals, acute care facilities. She can't call on hospitals in her current role. So as we prepared for the interview, I told her, and we prepared for about an hour, and this is one of the things that helps differentiate our candidates from a lot of the other candidates out there. And a lot of times a job seeker doesn't understand the criticality of role-playing, either with friends or family or a colleague, to role-play questions, develop the answers. But I asked her, I said, one of the questions that a hiring manager will probably ask you, Kim, is, why are you looking to leave your current company? And she said, well, I'll tell them because I want to reduce my travel from 90% to about 50%. And I said, that answer right there will probably kick you out of the process. She goes, well, it's true, and I don't understand how that could be. Well, this leads to one of the themes in the book that I call the shadows on the wall syndrome. Anything we say can and will be used against us. And if we cast
I like that.
And if we cast a shadow on the wall, it's sort of like when we were 4 or 5 years old and our parents would put us to bed, or if we have kids today, we put the kids to bed and you walk down the hall and about 15 seconds later, Dad, I'm thirsty. Well, no, they're not thirsty. They're scared, and they're scared because of the monster under the bed, the skeleton in the closet, the shadow on the wall that's being cast by the streetlight or moonlight shining through the trees. There is an unfounded fear. So as an interviewee, if we aren't cognizant of that principle, we will cast unfounded fears on the hiring manager's wall, and they will eliminate us from the process. So Kim said, well, like I said, I'll tell them that I want to reduce travel from 90% to 50%. And I said, here's why that interview answer will cast a shadow on the wall and kick you out of the process. Number one, the person you're interviewing with does travel 90% of the time and doesn't see anything wrong with it. So they're going to go, well, if she's looking at leaving her current position for that reason, what's she not going to like about our company and want to quit for? So I said, Kim, here's a way to answer that question. I said, did I find you or did you find me? She goes, well, Skip, you called me. I said, so number one, you said you'd be open to an opportunity if it was stronger than what you're doing today, and I found you. Secondly, you told me you wanted to move into a sales role where you'd be calling on hospitals and acute care facilities. So let's craft the answer like this. Rather than saying you want to reduce travel from 90% to 50%, say, to the hiring manager, Mr. and Ms. Hiring Manager, it's not so much that I'm looking to leave my current company as it is that when Skip called me, and described this opportunity to me, I got excited about the fact that I can call on acute care facilities and hospitals with your organization, which will help me to advance my career. So we took it away
this
from
this guy's
what,
really good, isn't he? Wow.
So we took it away from why you want to leave something to why you want to move forward toward something. Now we are positioning her from a position of value and rarity, not just a commodity, and then that will position her more strongly. So that's just one of many examples to answer your question, Todd, on questions that interviewers ask, ways interviewees need to craft their responses to these questions and go through the process.
So you're on the recruiting side of things, right? You help candidates hire you to help place them somewhere, and businesses help you to help go through that process. Do you do any sourcing? And then what is the difference between sourcing and recruiting?
The difference between sourcing and recruiting, I will answer. Let me quickly rewind. As a recruiter, we are hired by the client to go out and find the best talent. So our role is not to help candidates find a new job. Our job is to help clients find the best people. It is an outplacement firm or a career coach that will help the candidates. So a lot of times people don't understand the role of a recruiter. I'll get candidates calling me up saying, Skip, can you help me find a job? Well, really, no. The thing I'm doing is helping clients find the best people. But the reason I wrote the book is to offer the things to candidates that they need to know to go out and find their next opportunity properly. Now, the difference between recruiting and sourcing is the fact that my job is to identify, qualify, attract, and land. So a lot of the sourcing is the identification of people in the industry who can do the job. So that's the sourcing part. The recruiting part actually is an extension of that. Now I begin to call into these companies after I've identified the people, ask them if they're open to an opportunity that might be superior than what they are doing today. If they say yes, I'll say, well, give me a two-minute overview of your background, then I'll give you a two-minute overview of the opportunity. Well, in that 2 minutes, as they begin to tell me what they've done, I can quickly determine whether or not they can really do the job and are they really an appropriate candidate for this opportunity, and that's where the extension into the recruiting world begins.
So you're responsible for helping an organization find talent for a position. So what percentage of the people that you ultimately hire into those positions are coming from jobs that they're currently comfortable in but didn't realize this opportunity was existed versus someone who's out there looking for a job?
In today's economic environment, companies will not pay a recruiter to bring them an unemployed person. And that's not to slight the unemployed whatsoever. It's to help the unemployed people understand that if you're trying to go through a recruiter, you're actually not optimizing your job search nor optimizing your time. I get paid 30% of a person's first year's base salary. So if an engineer, for example, is making $80,000, my fee is going to be $24,000. A company's not going to pay me $24,000 to bring them somebody who's not currently doing the job. So again, a reason I wrote the book is to give the folks that I can't help, the people that I cannot place, the same insight, the same headhunter hiring secrets that my candidates learn that they can apply themselves.
This morning's show has a little bit of a military theme. A little bit later in the show, we're going to visit with a I don't guess there's such a thing as an ex-fighter pilot, so I would just say fighter pilot, who's doing some marvelous work out there, taking some really critical lessons of leadership and execution from the military arena and bringing them to other organizations. But you have a military background as well. You're an ex-West Point, you're a West Point grad and a ex-West Point instructor. The reason I bring it up, what impact, if any, has that military background had on the way that you run your business and the way that you coach your clients?
Well, Stone, great question. I graduated from the Military Academy in 76 and served 10 years in the Corps of Engineers as well as the Army Chemical Corps before moving into business. And one of the things I learned while in the military is the criticality of having the right processes in place coupled with the right people. And that's the way I work with my clients and my candidates. I help them to understand from the hiring side, there is a proper process. From the job search side, there is likewise a proper process. Let's put the two together, and that's where the disconnect often occurs. And then, of course, any mission is going to only be accomplished if you have the right processes in place and the right people, the right team members. So it's critical to for a hiring manager to know how to interview. And let me interject here. When I say the rules of the hiring game have changed forever, one of the rules right now is most hiring managers do not know how to interview. They have a gut feel, but they really don't know what they need to know in order to interview properly. So that's one of the things I teach my candidates, as well as others who read this book, is there are certain things the candidate can do to help lead and guide that interview process to accomplish the mission. In other words, the company get the right person and the candidate get their career of choice.
So how can our listeners get their hands on this book, learn more about your work, and what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
The best way to get in touch with me is take a look at the website, headhunterhiringsecrets.com, and then my email address is skip@headhunterhiringsecrets.com, and the book is available on amazon.com.
Well, listen, before we let you go, Skip, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show, and I hope that your agent gave you a heads up on it. If not, we'll just drop it on you right here. But we like to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really, more importantly, what they feel like they learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
I would love to. In reflecting back over my career, I would say the biggest mistake that I have made is not understanding earlier in my career that your career is a game. If we come back again to the definition of a game of a situation or event with two or more people who can each gain or lose based upon the decisions others make or fail to make, you realize that almost everything in life is a game, the hiring game, the dating game, the sales game, what have you. Well, your career is a game, and if you understand game theory and apply it properly in your career, you're going to be far better off down the road than you are if you play the simply a game of chance and roll the dice. So one of the things I learned about halfway through my career is that there is game theory. There are ways to use strategies and skills to build your career, also ways to use strategies and skills in looking for your next opportunity versus just playing the game of chance. And I wish I'd learned that earlier, and that's what I'm trying to share with people today.
Well, thanks so much for being with us this morning. I hope you'll come back sometime.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Well, listen, can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Would love to.
Terrific. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show is a gentleman named Jim Murphy, and he is a U.S. Air Force fighter pilot who is the author of two books, Flawless Execution and Business is Combat. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Great to be here, Stone.
Well, tell us a little bit about your work and particularly about these books. What are you out there trying to share with folks?
Well, actually, our business started before the books back in 1996. We started a company called Afterburner, and originally it was Afterburner Seminars. And we were applying fighter pilot tools and techniques around strategic and tactical planning and applying them to business for not only the C-suite, the VP level, but all the way down into the management ranks, teaching a process to help companies actually execute at a higher level.
Well, you know, our last guest was really speaking to process, and it occurs to me that I grew up in a military town, but I don't have any military experience, but it occurs to me that the military has process for everything.
Absolutely, and that's one of the strengths. We believe that's a big execution gap in companies, whether it's an entrepreneurial company or a Global 2000 company. Afterburner, we mainly work with Global 2000 companies, but we know there are several execution gaps in most organizations. And there are a lot of great business process models out there. There's Six Sigma, there's Kaizen, there's TQM, there's a lot of great models out there. A lot of these processes are fairly complex. And one of the things that I learned as a fighter pilot and being around elite military members like U.S. Navy SEALs, et cetera, is that in order to scale our teams, our performance, the process itself needs to be very simple, because in the chaos of battle, you need to be able to fall back on a process that you can repeat, under a lot of stress. And in the business world, we believe if you're going to really scale a process throughout a large organization, that process should be fairly simple as well. Now, not necessarily based on statistical backgrounds or based on a 2 or 3 year rollout, it's something that you should be able to deploy very quickly into the field and create lift around your sales team, your ops team, or et cetera. And we believe the flawless execution model, which is the model we invented, is that model. We believe it's the next great business model.
Wasn't it Napoleon who said that the reason most generals fail is that their plans are too complicated?
You know, absolutely. And I think a lot of CEOs can see that as well. And in today's economic environment, flexibility is kind of the key. We have a saying in the fighter pilot world that flexibility is the key to air power. And at Afterburner, we take it one step further and we say preparation is the key to flexibility. And, you know, your earlier guest just, you know, alluded to this, whether you're trying to get hired or you're the hiring manager, you know, in today's world, it pays to be flexible. And if you want to show that ROI that you're talking about as a potential candidate, how to save money or how to make money, it's all about the planning and the preparation phases. And I think that's a lot of the stuff that we teach at Afterburner.
Well, to heck with all the business application of this stuff. Let's talk about the piloting stuff. Tell us the background of you being a U.S. Air Force fighter pilot.
Well, I actually started flying the F-15 right here in Atlanta, Georgia, at Dobbins Air Force Base. I was an instructor pilot for the 116th Fighter Wing, Georgia Air National Guard here. Started my career and then ended up down in Florida. Started flying in 1989, got out of the military around 2000, the year 2000. Started Afterburner, however, when I was still in the Guard and Reserves. You know, the whole idea behind Afterburner and teaching flawless execution came just 18 months after I started with the Air Force. I grew up in central Kentucky in a very small rural area, and actually after college, sold copiers for a couple years to small rural businesses. And met a fighter pilot. This person made a huge impression on me, decided to look into it, was fortunate enough to get selected to go into pilot training. And in just 18 months, I'm with seven of the top pilots in all the Air Force getting ready to solo the F-15, which at the time was arguably the most sophisticated jet on Earth. And I was sitting here reflecting back 18 months ago. I was walking around in Shelby County, Kentucky, selling copiers to small companies. And the Air Force has just entrusted me with one of their most precious assets. You know, how did I get here? You know, because I was just like anybody else out there. And I realized that the military had a very unique process on assessing people, but more importantly, the process of getting us to that point where we could execute at a high level, even before maybe individually we were even ready for it. And what was kind of interesting is not only the fighter pilots, but the maintainers, the weapons loaders, the high-performance team that was around us as fighter pilots, we were all executing at a very high level, maybe even above what we thought our education levels had carried us at that point. And, you know, we were barely making minimum wage for our education levels as well. We were willing to risk our lives on somebody's mission objective we've never even met before. So I said, wow, if corporate America could just get 1/100th of this esprit de corps, this attention to detail, this process around executing at a high level, you know, think how effective they would have been and think about how many more copiers I would have been able to sell if I would have had that training before I went into business.
Well, and organizations have really resonated with this idea. Your concept apparently is meeting with a great deal of success. What is it that you think that people that may not even have a military background resonate with so quickly and so easily?
It has been very successful. We started, like I said, in 1996. We've already put over 1.5 million executives through our programs.
Isn't that something?
We've been in 38 countries. We do between 250 and 300 events a year. And most of our clients, we penetrated 23% of the Fortune 500. I think the biggest thing that resonates with our training is there's this assumption around discipline. And a lot of people make a lot of different assumptions about it, but it's really about the process. And if the process is executed very well, you know, there's that assumption of discipline. And I think where a lot of people see fighter pilots, elite military professionals, one of the first things that business executives look at is they say, we need that kind of disciplined approach in our business. But right below that disciplined veneer is a process that's scalable, and that's what we teach at Afterburner.
Well, I just got through training for a marathon, or half marathon that I ran this past weekend, and the science behind it, the strategy behind it is nothing complicated, but it requires, there is a training process, but you have to be disciplined to execute it. It seems to me that a business either doesn't have the process right, or they don't have the discipline to execute on that process. What do you find is the more common problem?
That's a great point. I think it's the process. And I think the reason is let's just take planning, for example. You know, every company on Earth says, we're going to get together and set our strategic plan for the year, right? So that percolates down throughout the organization. And by September 15th, by God, I want everybody in the company to have their plans to their managers, and then we're going to be ready to set forth on our new strategic plan for the following year. So everybody scrambles to get their plan together, and they put some sort of document together to support the company's top-line revenue goal and their EBITDA or their net revenue goal. But there's not really any type of process on how to plan for the actions and activities that equate to that budgeted outcome. So the companies just say plan, but they don't tell anybody how to plan. You know, what's the exact template? What process are we going to use? And, you know, that's the big execution gap. An example might be this. A lot of companies have great strategic initiatives. You know, an initiative might be, you know, we're going to focus on commercial clients this year. Maybe it's a retailer, like Home Depot, for example. You know, we know that we've maybe saturated part of the DIY market. Now we're going to go after commercial contractors, so to speak. So maybe the strategic initiative is we're going to increase, you know, commercial business. Well, you know, how does that really change the actions and the behaviors of the folks down at the troop level? Until you plan and get those strategic initiatives down to the tactical level, where they actually change actions and activities, which is rarely what happens in business. So the middle managers make the same mistake by just turning to their group and go, we're going to focus on contractors more. They don't really tell the folks exactly how that's going to happen. What's going to happen in the next 4 weeks? Every commercial contractor will be greeted. They will be given a card and will receive their email or their phone number so we can start building a database. I mean, you know, they don't really get down to that fractal level.
I am absolutely fascinated with something I was reading as I was doing my extensive pre-show research, you know, that Todd and I always do, with this idea, this embed program. Can you say more about that?
Absolutely. We at Afterrunner, we started out as a seminar training experiential learning company. And then after we would do a one-hour keynote or teach a company how to identify and eliminate task saturation, you know, how do we execute by doing more with less, companies would say, you know, we heard you talk about that on stage, but now come into our organization and change our culture. So we started consulting and training more and doing a lot of long-term recurring revenue events with clients. And then some of our clients started hiring our people, our consultants away. And we're a pretty small company. So although our clients are huge, it takes about 2 years for us to take a elite military professional and get them to the point where they can go buckle to buckle with a C-suite executive and talk EBITDA or talk sales pipeline with them. So if somebody like that leaves our company, it leaves a pretty good hole in our company.
Yeah.
So we quickly realized that the worst thing to do would be to go after our great clients about this, even though they signed a contract. The best thing to do is turn this into an opportunity. So like Skip, we saw an incredible opportunity out there to not only help our brothers and sisters that are veterans, but to help our clients. So what we started doing is going to our clients and going, would you like somebody like one of these Afterburner folks? Absolutely. The discipline they exude, the process they exude, they use flawless execution. That's what we need. Well, great. We can find those people for you. So now we go out and handpick elite military professionals based on our clients' needs. We then, on our dime, bring those clients to candidates to Atlanta, and we put them through our Flawless Execution University. It's an intensive course where we teach them and certify them on how to use our strategic tactical planning model, Flawless Execution, which is based on their military roots, so they quickly adapt to it. But in the process, we also give them military to business vernacular training. So now when they do go to that interview or they do have the first year in the business suite, they feel a lot more comfortable. Where a lot of our military candidates fall short is they come out and they're military geeks, so to speak. They don't understand the language of business, but the young men and women coming out of the military right now are getting the best leadership training on earth by trial through fire in Afghanistan and Iraq. I can't say this more. Businesses can't find a better candidate on earth. And right now, we've got a giant dearth in leadership in corporate America. These are the individuals that will help you with that. So we help them connect their military vernacular to business vernacular, and then we actually place them with clients that are already utilizing our flawless execution services.
Can you describe what your website talks about, the flawless execution model? Can you talk a little bit about that?
The flawless execution model was born and bred in the zero tolerance for error world of elite military professionals and military aviation. It has three components. It's shaped like a triangle or a pyramid. The top part of the model is all about building the purpose of an organization. Most organizations demand detailed execution day in and day out, don't they?
Sure.
But one of the biggest execution gaps is that the leadership fails to put details into where the organization needs to be in the future. And we call that building the purpose. We believe that organizations cannot really be effective if they just have vision, mission, and goals. There's not enough detail there in today's economic environment. We believe that the leadership needs to build purpose that is clear, compelling, but must have high resolution. So the different parts of an organization knows exactly what they're doing today aligns with the detailed blueprint of the future. Very few organizations build that blueprint. So we teach C-suites how to do that. It's also we also utilize some of the methods that were used during shock and awe, Desert Storm 1, on how to affect quick change in systems by attacking in parallel. And we probably don't have enough time to go into that, but that's part of our strategic model. Then at the base of the model, not going to get to the core of it yet, is something that we call platform. And we believe if organizations want to scale their business, they need to have standard operating procedures or standards, which is what the military is all about. They need to be able to train while they're flying or train on the fly or train during combat. We call that demo do training without having expensive long-term training departments. And we also believe that they need to assess the right people in the right areas of the organization. Get people on the bus in the right seats, as our friend Jim Collins would say. But the core of our model is right in the heart or the engine of the model, and that's what everybody in the organization should do. They should have a process that drives accountability around every action or mission within the organization that supports the purpose. They should plan, brief, execute, and debrief around each and every one of those activities. And we teach a six-step planning model. We teach companies how to brief that plan on a daily basis so there's no question on the direction tactically that everybody is going. We teach them to execute the pre-brief plan by eliminating performance-draining task saturation, and you can ask me about that here in a second. But when the mission is over, we believe the most important thing that we teach is those teams go into a room and debrief in a nameless, rankless environment where they strictly look at what happened based on what they said was supposed to happen without the fear of reprimand, where people freely admit the errors or the successes of that mission, get them out on the table so we never repeat them again. We take those lessons learned, put them back into the next plan, and we make it tighter or better. And when the entire organization is doing this, plan, brief, execute, debrief, lessons learned, back into the next plan, those plans are getting tighter and tighter, their execution levels are getting higher and higher, and a big organization can stay one step ahead of the competitive rate of change in their environment every day instead of waiting once a quarter, once a half, or once a year like most companies do.
Well, you talk about most companies. I can assure you, and I don't know this model very well beyond that marvelous description, I guarantee you there are a lot of organizations that do a horrible job, if anything, in the area of debriefing.
We've been keeping records, and those are what these two books that you alluded to earlier are all about. But statistically, we've probably looked at over 40,000 surveys post our seminars of individuals, and we've asked them, how well does your organization plan, brief, execute, and debrief? And the national average for debrief is less than a 3.25.
Wow.
So that doesn't surprise
me. On a scale
me.
Of 1 to 10.
It doesn't me either. That's absolutely. So, yeah, do tell us a little bit more about these two books. And please do circle back to this other term that we've heard a couple of times now, task saturation.
Well, right now, corporate America and global 2,000 companies around the world are task saturated. I mean, we are asking everybody to do more with less, and that's just the way we have to do business right now. But there are ways to combat the performance-draining aspects of task saturation. So what is task saturation? Task saturation is the perception or the reality of having too much to do with not enough time, tools, or resources to get the mission at hand accomplished. And we know at Afterburner, as task saturation increases, errors actually increase. As task saturation increases, performance decreases. But companies sometimes are proud of the amount of task saturation they're shouldering. So first, we point out that it is a detriment to performance. And second, we teach companies that its slow and insidious nature of its onset is something that managers and leaders should understand. And then we give companies tools to eliminate task saturation.
I mean, to me, that is incredibly important to organizations. And I think you and I, and even in our little consulting practice, Todd, we run into individuals that almost wear this big badge of courage that they're so busy and they got so much going on. And it's that same dynamic really at play on a larger scale, isn't it?
You know, Stone, we actually use that same visual, you know, when we're in our seminars.
Oh, really?
We'll point to our uniforms, our flight suits, and say, you know, some companies actually wear task saturation of a as a patch of honor on their flight suit. So just like you touched your shoulder, you bet that's on everybody's minds. And healthcare, for instance, 250,000 people, depending on the numbers you look at, between 100,000 and 200,000 die every year in North American hospitals because of basic execution errors due to task saturation. Sometimes wow. in the OR and the ER, but there's a lot of focus now being put on patient safety and executing better in our hospital and healthcare centers. So we know that the flawless execution model will help increase levels of situational awareness in healthcare and decrease errors. I mean, wouldn't you like it, or wouldn't you like to think that, you know, after your grandmother or your mother had surgery, that the surgical team would actually go into a room and debrief? Or more importantly, don't you think they should brief before surgery occurs?
I'm going to ask my hospital, my doctor from now on, are you working with Afterburner?
Well, we've worked hard on that. And, you know, now it's starting to be an important process in healthcare. There are other companies that have been focusing on aviation techniques into healthcare. We're one of them. But, this has become a big thing. As a matter of fact, I met Dennis Quaid years ago, and he is in Cannes, I guess, right now in France. They're rolling out a new movie that's going to be broadcast on the Discovery Channel that really highlights aviation techniques into patient safety. So I'm excited about that. Looking forward to seeing that.
Oh, cool. I like Dennis, too. So tell us more about these books.
Well, Business as Combat was produced in the year 2000. Both books are HarperCollins. Flawless Execution is our latest book. And then we just released the Flawless Execution Handbook in February of this year. And these books outline the flawless execution model: how to plan, brief, execute, debrief, how to create a nameless, rankless culture in your organization, how to combat performance draining, task saturation, all the things that we've alluded to today. Now, you know, over on the embed side, the placement side, obviously, you know, our books mainly talk about our model itself. But if you're interested in any of our three business models, Empower is what we call our seminar model, business model. Equip is what we call our training and consulting model, and a lot about the flawless execution business process models itself and the software that supports it. And then Embed is our military transition placement firm within Afterburner. Go to afterburner.com and you can click into one of those three business units to learn more about them.
Jim, you talk about nameless, rankless organizations, but yet the military, in my mind, works because of the chain of command. Explain, there seems to be a conflict there in my mind. Explain that to me.
It's a great point, Todd. A lot of people perceive that to be true. And within the military, however, we have high-performance teams, Navy SEALs, fighter pilots. There's many of them out there. Rank is very, very important. So important we wear it on our shoulders, right? I mean, in the Air Force, we salute cars that have spray-painted white tops whether anybody's in the car or not. Now, if you ask about corporations, they'll tell you there's certainly rank in their business as well. It may not be near as obvious, but actually it could be even more insidious. But when we're dealing with the mission itself, there's always rank. But when it comes time to debrief, as a fighter pilot, we go into a room, and sometimes we physically rip the rank off of our shoulders and the name tags off of our chest. That's why they're on Velcro, because wow. This symbolizes that when you go into that room, this isn't rank and file time. This is focus on what we said we were going to do time, because the mission precedes everything. The mission's the most important thing. So let's go into that room. Let's throw a rank out the door, and let's focus on what we said we were going to do and what actually happened in a nameless, rankless environment. Because if we don't create that open environment, we will never get anybody to bring out the real root causes of the errors or the successes of the mission in fear of reprimand or fear of political repercussions within the organization. So the military learned a long time ago, because if we execute poorly, people don't come back from their missions, that we have to have a place, a microclimate for success, where we call time out from the normal entrappings of an organization and go into nameless, rankless mode.
See, I get this now. See, the problem with most organizations is that the too many managers that love their rank, love their power, and they achieve that power by building a culture of task saturation.
There you go. That's right.
Got it.
I think you got a good handle on it. We
got
can
it.
Get you in the embed program, maybe.
Absolutely.
You're very insightful. Well, listen, speaking of task saturation, and obviously you figured out a way for that not to happen to you, but you've got a lot of other things going as well. You're the spokesperson for the national program called Gradient Gives Back. Tell us a little bit more about that.
This is a great program. Gradient Financial, great company. They created this program several years ago, and Bill Rancic was their national spokesperson, and they were doing financial makeovers for deserving families out there that were having a hard time. And this year, Gradient decided to focus on our veterans and our military families, and they asked Afterburner to help out, and we're glad to do that. We're excited about it. And they are actually going to take three deserving military veterans and their families and highlight them this year and give them a full financial makeover, meaning they're going to give them 6 months free mortgage. They are going to, for the next 2 years, if they decide to then get into a new home, they're going to waive their origination fees. They're going to give them tax planning and advice, so when they go to file for their taxes this year and next year, all that work will be done for free for these families. Credit and debt advice, and then a lifetime of coaching by the Gradient Coaching Network, a financial coaching network. So it's a very, very cool program. And then at the end of the year, Afterburner is actually going to hold a Flawless Execution University for candidates, potential candidates that would like to get a job through all the applications that get collected throughout the year. And what's pretty neat is then we're going to put a class together here in Atlanta, Georgia. Those candidates, the deserving candidates, will be flown in, all expense paid, and then we'll put them through this Flawless Execution University. They'll get military to business vernacular training. They'll get resume training. They'll get training on how to actually do a nice job on the interview. And then they'll get actually interviewed by a company called Bath Fitter. And it's a franchisor here in the United States and Canada that does bath remodeling. It's a fairly large company. And they're going to be hiring quite a few people, and they're looking for some of our candidates to then put right into leadership positions within their company, running some of their locations and running some of their sales and operations areas. So we're excited to be a member of both Gradient and Bath Fitter, to be a team member. We're going to get those candidates ready, and then they're going to hopefully get selected to their next career with Bath Fitter. So we're excited about that.
What a marvelous program, and it has to be incredibly rewarding work. I can't imagine the challenge that so many military families must face when they're trying to re-enter the non-military life. My hat is just off to you guys for doing that.
It's going to be fun work. I mean, you really think about the opportunity out there for your listeners, and if you're corporate leaders, I hope you really are sitting up a little bit tighter in your chair right now, because you've got a wave of outstanding applicants coming your way. 220,000 young men and women are going to be transitioning out of our military over the next few years, and potentially those numbers may increase depending on what goes on in the two conflicts right now. But there's just a great opportunity to get some great young leaders into your corporation. So I just am excited about more companies, you know, being exposed to these great leaders, and it's just a great program to be associated with.
Yeah. Well, so how can our listeners find out more about this effort as well as Afterburner and find out about your books? What's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Well, afterburner.com is our website. So I encourage you to go there. And if you want to buy any of our books, you can buy them on Amazon or buy them through our website at afterburner.com or wherever you like to buy your books. But Gradient has their own dedicated website for this program that we're rolling out. It's called GradientGivesBack.org. So I'd encourage you to go to GradientGivesBack.org. And if you're a veteran, please go there and apply.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show, Jim. Before we let you go, you probably saw us do this with our first guest. We do have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show where we like to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career. And, well, you know what? It's a little bit reminiscent of the process. You have the debrief. could we get you to do that for us? Share a mistake that you made and what you feel like you learned from it.
Well, I've made a lot, so that was a tough assignment. So I decided, I knew we'd probably be talking mainly about corporations, so I thought I would focus on my own entrepreneurism. And, you know, I've been blessed. I had a lot of opportunities that the Air Force gave me that I was able to get a job as a commercial airline pilot shortly after I got out of the military. And unfortunately, I started Afterburner just several weeks before I was hired by this major airline. And Afterburner really took off. Our first client was Home Depot, and we ended up training all 2,000 of their managers at the time in 96 and 97 through our program. So I was very busy and also trying to learn how to fly a commercial airliner, and was still flying in the Air National Guard as an instructor pilot in the F-15. So I was juggling three balls, And I wanted to hang on to all of them because I was worried that one or the other may not work out. And I know some of your listeners possibly have been there before. And I was very passionate about what I was doing in the military. I thought financially the airline job was going to be great for me long term. And yet my real passion, and I thought that where I really should be putting my energies was into this whole business thing. You know, who would have thought that fighter pilots teaching businesses how to execute would have turned into be the business that it is today? So for about 4 or 5 years, I tried to hang on to all three. And talking about task saturated, I was very task saturated. I was not a very good airline pilot. I was not a very good F-15 pilot at the time, and I was not a very good business person at the time. So I realized that, hey, I need to focus on one thing. So I resigned from the airlines, resigned from my military career, and focused full-time on Afterburner. And looking back on it, I wished I'd have done it a lot earlier because I think Afterburner would have been further along, and I just think that would have been the right move. And I see a lot of people do that, and I know it's kind of weird to talk about all those opportunities in today's economic environment, but if you do have a passion and you're thinking about making a move, you know, a lot of times, you know, sitting on the fence for a long time, you know, does more harm than good.
Well, you're very gracious to share the experience and be vulnerable for the benefit of our listeners, and it's obviously was a good call in the end, and we're just delighted for you, and hope you'll come back and tell us about some more stuff going on with Afterburner another time, maybe.
Looking forward to it. Thanks for the opportunity.
You are more than welcome. Until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, Jim Murphy, Skip Freeman, our producer Lee Cantor, and everyone here at the Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.